This podcast features three supposed adults who definitely use adult language. They're also supposedly writers who are definitely not procrastinating by making this podcast. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to No Bad Ideas, the storytelling game show where we take the worst ideas from the internet and try to turn them into stories that are actually good.
My name is Gabriel Urbina, and I am your first Bad Ideas host.
My name is Sarah Shackett. I'm your second Bad Ideas host.
And my name is Zach Valenti, your third Bad Ideas host.
And today we are joined here at Bad Ideas HQ by a special guest star, one of the shining stars of the audio fiction firmament, actually. They are the creator of Girl in Space, as well as the Right Now podcast with Sarah Werner. It's Ari Werner. How are you doing?
Hey, friends. Great. I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for that kind introduction. And I'm really excited about the show.
Excellent.
Oh, my gosh.
Excellent.
We're so glad to have you.
Thank you.
It's a long time coming.
Now, Sarah, before we launch into talking about bad ideas, let's take just a moment and talk about good ideas. Just in case anyone listening is not familiar with your oeuvre, do you want to talk for a second about what your shows are about?
Yeah. I like having an oeuvre. I've never thought about that before. Girl in Space is an audio drama about a girl in space. I love that I named it that. It makes it very easy to explain.
Truth in advertisement, if we've really ever heard it.
I just think I'm basic, but season two is coming out soon. I've been saying season two is coming out soon since 2019, so it's coming soon.
Yeah, you've had us all on the hook for a little bit.
Some stuff has happened in the interim, both on Earth and in space.
This is very true. I have all the excuses. And then the Right Now podcast, and that's WRITE because puns, is a show for writers and creators. It deals mostly with what it means to live a creative life, to fit creativity into your life, and all of that good stuff.
Both are highly, highly recommended. If you are listening to this show, you likely enjoy both out of this world stories and thoughtful reflections on the creative process and how it can sometimes be an uphill battle, even if it is a rewarding one. So we highly, highly recommend both Girl in Space and Right Now. But only
but
after
right
you've
now,
finished listening to this podcast. Exactly, yes.
We have business to do.
Oh, yes.
And do we ever, because I am delighted to bring you to a new publication. Burials and Beyond had a blog post on a not so timely, but very 90s death.
What?
The Tamagotchi Cemetery.
I want nothing to do with this already.
Oh, yes.
This is amazing.
Quote, I thought it would be better for him here because I didn't really want to reset him because it would be like a different thing and I was really close to him. I know that sounds stupid, but I was. But you can bury your pets, and if you love something else, you can bury them as well. So said young mourner Danielle Perrin in 1997.
I see.
Interning her pet into the beautiful farmland of Ponce Mill, Cornwall, Danielle's beloved friend was placed into a tiny wooden coffin and buried in a small square grave, there to rest in peace. Danielle's grief was very real, but her pet, not so much. That was a Tamagotchi.
Wow.
For anybody who doesn't know, some context. In 1996, Japanese toy designers Aki Maita and Yokoi Kiro debuted their first ever Tamagotchi. The tiny plastic case held the world's first virtual pet, which, despite being a simple arrangement of pixels, required constant care and attention lest the creature perish. Released by Bandai, the egg-shaped toy was one of the biggest fads of the 90s, maintaining a surprising popularity over the decades, with over 82 million units sold as of 2017.
They say fad. I say important. I say formative moments for many of us.
The name itself is a portmanteau of two Japanese words, tamago, meaning egg, and utochi, meaning watch. Considering the product is an egg-shaped toy the size of a watch, it seems to be pretty solid marketing. And the writer goes on to describe what it was like to be in school in the 90s with a room full of Tamagotchi screaming for attention until they were banned from schools. And
that happened very quickly.
Their own personal experience.
I was in that classroom.
And the television program that depicted death in Tamagotchi land.
Okay, I did not see that one. That one is news to me.
As a blog about death and dying, but we'll cut to the pet cemetery in 1996. A pet cemetery in Ponce Mill, Cornwall was the first to diversify their internments and fence off a dedicated section for the burial of electronic pets. When CNN reported in 1997, they equated this very modern mourning with the established love that British people have of their traditional breathing pets. On January 17th, 1997, two teenage girls were in Cornwall to bury their Tamagotchis named Sid and Artie, two consoles never to be reset.
Wow.
Huh.
I thought this was supposed to be bad ideas.
The author's first thought, as a very outdated parental shock, they say, was that Tamagotchis aren't terribly cheap when they came out. And so to bury a brand new toy feels awfully wasteful, as well as taking another expensive trip to Argos wouldn't have gone too well in my household. However, 14-year-old Danielle was strong in her resolve and placed the little plastic contraption into the earth. She was not alone in her beliefs either, as cemetery owner Terry Squires revealed that many international burials had been carried out in his Cornish field. Tamagotchis from as far afield as Switzerland, Germany, France, Canada, and America had all been laid to rest in his pet cemetery, with many more on the way. However, looking at Ponce Mill today, there are no mentions to be found of deceased cyber pets, with the business promoting itself solely as a pet cemetery and green burial site for traditional human internments. The author would be curious to know if the rudimentary headstones remain, or if the Tamagotchis and their mournful batteries were turned over or forgotten as other crazes came and went. There is an adorable photo of the Tamagotchi graves, as sad as any death is. It's quite cute. The link in the description. And the rest of the article is a lot of pontificating and sort of thinking out loud about our relationships with digital things, with, I think, the most notable final note touching on a 27-year-old Japanese man known only by the media as Sal9000, who was so emotionally invested in the DS game Love Plus that he decided to marry the main avatar in a lavish, if highly controversial, ceremony in 2009. Which is a little bit double dipping in badness.
Yeah, there's just a lot going on in that one sentence.
Yeah.
Yes, I will end with Sal9000's response when questioned as to whether he could truly love a digital pre-programmed woman. He explained, "I love this character, not a machine." Going on to say, "I understand 100% this is a game, and I understand very well that I cannot marry her legally or physically." However, his preference for the digital, predictable, and placid provoked far more discussion, explaining that this character, Neen, was better than a, quote, a real girlfriend. He listed her perks, stating that she doesn't get angry if I'm late in replying to her. Well, she gets angry, but she forgives me quickly.
So she's basically like a Stepford wife.
More or less.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
You know.
But even less real.
So Sal is not alone in his preference, and several others have followed in his stead, marrying digital characters in ceremonies across the world. In 2018, Japan hit the headlines again as a 35-year-old school administrator married the hologram of a video game character, Hatsune Miku. Whether these marriages will last when the bride's updates are discontinued is another matter, but our changing relationship with life, love, and death in the digital age is undeniable. On which note, I'll thank you for taking this strange journey with me and take my leave. My CompuKitty needs feeding.
Before you set the timer, just to be clear.
Yes.
What was the connection between Sal9000 and the Tamagotchi Cemetery? Or was it just like, here's another example of a person engaging with digital life in a way that most of us engage with real life?
It's just a
life.
It's a tangent and a broader part of a broader reflection of our relationships to digital devices. And
got
digital beings.
Got it. Cool.
And I just thought it was too good to not throw in there, even though it is a little bit off the cemetery mark, in case you guys prefer that angle. So with that, I put 10 minutes on the clock.
All right.
Alrighty.
I love Tamagotchis, but the idea of like marrying a digital person that then gets updated at periodic points is like fascinating to me.
I feel like the story of the digital creation that gets mistreated and then somehow kind of comes back and like rebuilds itself a new body and then like goes after the people that mistreated it. I think I've seen that a couple of times and it's never quite as awesome as I want it to be. Like it's always kind of weirdly underwhelming and weirdly sort of this like, wait, am I supposed to feel pathos for this thing? Am I supposed to feel scared of it? Is this what's going on here? So I don't think that like Stephen King's Pet Sematary, but with Tamagotchis that have reconstituted themselves.
That's the movie that would get sold, but it's not the movie I think that we should
make. That's already in development, copyright, Michael Bay.
That's just turning the bad idea into a different bad idea.
Yes. Right. But there are certain bad ideas that we cannot stop.
It's true. It's true. But yeah, but I'm trying to think about kind of like what is the actual good story concept that could be spun out of all of this.
I mean, we haven't tried 6 feet under, but for digital things.
Tell me more.
This is where you're supposed to pick up on the very vague notion I have dropped and actually make it good, Gabrielle.
I see. Okay, no, but there might be something there. If there is a pet cemetery for digital pets, presumably there are undertakers for these things.
Yeah.
The same way that if all these strange men are marrying holograms, there has to be someone that is officiating these ceremonies. So it might be interesting to have a story about facilitators.
Yeah, for liaisons. These things. Yeah.
Because I imagine most of these things are questionably legal. And definitely
or just not. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So there might be something to kind of the underworld person that helps connect you with these services and with these ceremonies.
Yeah. And I'm just trying to think about sort of what our entry point into that would be, whether it's like someone who has a small child who is inconsolable over the death of their Tamagotchi, or whether it's someone who has kind of been burnt out doing something in the real world, but finds that they can be that facilitator in the digital space or something like that. I'm not sure which one is the right way in for us.
What's it called when you replace numbers with letters to spell words, or letters with numbers?
Leet speak.
Leet speak.
So I said with so much disdain in my voice.
House of God, Leet speak. Your first digital cathedral, marriages, funerals, communions. Whatever you need for your digital partner, pet, or whatever else, a caretaker. I'm not sure what other things are digital in this world.
Also, is there like discrimination or like a difference between digital objects that don't have sentience and objects like with an artificial intelligence that might be arguably sentient?
I think that this may actually be a good question to... I think that you're both kind of putting your finger on two sides of a similar question, which is... when is this story taking place? I.e., you know, is this kind of a quirky independent comedy that comes out next year and it's about someone that is doing it in our current technological setting? Or is this a story that's happening 50 years in the future when a lot more of life has presumably become digital?
This is your halfway warning.
Okay, thank you. And my knee-jerk reaction, since apparently we're running out of time, is to do it in the former rather than the latter, because we're a little bit more familiar with these things. And we'll be able to mind them more for comedy, but I could be persuaded.
Yeah, I wonder if there's even something to going a little bit more period with it and like starting in the 90s.
Even more indie.
Right. And then, yeah, exactly. Get Anya Taylor-Joy just into a different period costume every year.
A24 just, you know, greenlit this movie and hired Saoirse Ronan to star in it.
Oh,
along with Anya Taylor-Joy.
Yeah, of course. But then you could tell an interesting story about like how our relationships to digital things change over time. Like, you know, you have someone grieving over a Tamagotchi and like really tied to their Neopets, and sort of how that changes as we get further into the future.
Boom. Okay. Saoirse Ronan and Anya Taylor-Joy in this movie, they have a daughter and their daughter, taking place in like 1997, their daughter, their Tamagotchi dies. Their daughter throws such a fit and is so depressed and so terrible that these two women are finally like, well, you know what? Let's have a funeral service for it. And they do it and they think it's going to be a one-time thing. But then, you know, 1 week later, knock, knock, knock. Hey, this other kid from the neighborhood's Tamagotchi died. And so they kind of accidentally find this like grief counseling business for Tamagotchis. I think that that may be the way to do it.
I love that. And like the warm lesson is that, you know, if they're not sentient, what you're doing is like projecting yourself into this object. And like, so they have to do like, oh my gosh, like it's essentially grief counseling. It's therapy. It's so warm.
I think that may be it.
It can take place in a beach town so that it looks warm and gorgeous the entire time.
Oh my God.
As you ponder our inevitable mortality.
I mean, yes, of course.
And what part of you do you lose when you lose a Neopet?
Exactly.
Right.
What part don't you lose?
That's even scarier.
I don't know how it escalates. Like, I kind of don't know what, like, the next step in the plot ladder is.
It depends on how heartfelt versus comedic I think we want to go. Because, like, there's a comedic version where the actual sort of clergy in the town or the funeral home is like, hey, you're not licensed. Stop doing this.
Right. And then there's the version of it where halfway through the movie, like, the kid's grandfather actually dies.
Yes.
And now instead of dealing with, like, the digital death, you have to deal with, like, real death.
Exactly. Either valid. I just don't know which one we want to do.
Both?
Why choose? All right.
Well, great then.
Both is good.
So half of it is a wooden overcoat style romp where they're arguing with this, you know, like stickler priest who is like, no. You can only grieve the way that I tell you to grieve. Stop that. This whole connecting with your spiritual self and growing larger is not correct. I deny it. I chastise
you for it. Just feel bad and then say nothing.
Yes. And then come to my house and say the words that I tell you to say. That's what will really help you. And then those proceedings are immediately brought to a screeching halt when a real person in these people's lives actually passes away.
And they want to do the memorial service for the grandfather. Mm-hmm. And the clergy's like, no, that's my job. You only do... Uh-huh. And so then there's like a little bit of a struggle there.
That actually fits a lot better than I possibly considered it.
Seriously, we should call A24 about this.
In the 45 seconds you have left, do we have a name?
Oh, God. I would need to like refresh myself in like Tamagotchi land. Like, I wonder if there's like a message that Tamagotchi gave you when they died or something. Because if there is, it would completely be that.
I think it just showed like a gravestone or like a little like halo. Mm.
Digital halo. No.
That's not bad.
Not bad.
But it's not good either.
That's often where we live.
And that's time.
All right. Well.
It slipped away.
That was delightful.
In the last minute of the movie, does the guy with the holographic wife show up just to make things? No.
I think he's in his own movie already. I don't think he needs to be in ours.
Or it's like super in the background.
There's a sitcom that they watch that's about that.
There you go. It would be like a sitcom about someone trying to marry Princess Peach or something.
We'll run it by A24.
Look, in roughly like 20 years, there's going to be like no longer a strong consensus of when the technology started existing and when they didn't. Yeah, so we'll be able to let it slide if we just like wait long enough. All right. Well, that's one idea down. Sarah, do you have our next course?
I do. And it is also small and delightful. I love that we sort of unconsciously brought tiny ideas today, because I have one for you from the BBC.
Okay.
And dear listeners, if you would like to see the pictures, which I highly recommend, or read the article that I'm about to say aloud, then please go to the link in the description. So just for you, Sarah Werner, I have erotic books note attacks the cesspit. Hebden Bridge.
Huh? What?
Okay.
I will explain all of these words.
Okay, thank you.
I only understood
I understood erotic, and then that's where my understanding stopped.
So a small village became the unlikely center of attention after a resident apparently took offense at books inside of its mini library. An angry message railing against pornographic titles was stuck to the book swap box in Cornholm, West Yorkshire. I will read the note, which is in all caps with some really creative spacing and spelling, I want to add. It says, notice. And then in smaller font size, but all caps still, whoever is placing the copies, C-O-P-Y-S, of pornographic literature in here, stop. Cornholm is a good, God-fearing Christian village. If this filth is to your liking, may we suggest that you move to the cess, all one word, pit, separate word, that is Hebden Bridge.
This is the same priest from the first movie.
So the article continues. Locals at Hebden Bridge thanked the anonymous author for the free publicity. A photo of the sign, which defended the good God-fearing folk of Cornholm, was widely shared on Twitter and liked more than 13,000 times. Liz Thorpe, 57, decorated the book box with a stenciled butterfly and flower design after it was installed about 6 weeks ago. She found out about the sticker, which has since been removed, when she saw a photo of it on social media. Quote, I thought it was quite offensive, she said. I think people's perception of what is pornographic can vary enormously. I don't know why, if they found something they deemed inappropriate, they just didn't take it away. Mrs. Thorpe said the box contained run-of-the-mill paperbacks, including books for children, and nothing that could have caused offense.
Look, sometimes you just want to complain, okay?
That's true. But then when the BBC visited on Friday, they sent a reporter out to look at this box. They found titles by Ruth Rendell, Wilbur Smith, and Maeve Binchy. Some have questioned whether the sign was actually installed by a local wind-up merchant, but 60-year-old Russell King from Todborton believes otherwise. He said he saw the image on Twitter and came down to Cornholm to see what the fuss was about. Quote, I'm not surprised. I know the area, and it is a God-fearing place. It's a good way to describe it, he said. I think it was genuinely felt. I don't think it was a joke, he said. As word of the strange sign spread to Hebden Bridge, being branded as a cesspit seemed to amuse rather than annoy. The town, which is 7 miles away from Cornholm, has an arty reputation in a number of independent shops and is a popular filming location, with shows including Happy Valley being shot there. Local councillor Josh Fenton Glynn shared an image of the sign on Twitter and said it was great publicity for Hebden Bridge. He was, however, sure to praise its local rival and admitted Cornholm was, quote, a lovely place with some nice pubs.
Wow.
So I have brought for you the pettiest grievance between two towns that I've ever heard. And I'm putting 10 minutes on the timer. Tell me how much trouble you can get into with a book swap box.
I have no idea what the story is, but the movie is called A God-Fearing Town. For sure. Like, whatever happens in it, that's the title right there.
There you go.
Oh my God, people sometimes just need to complain, even if they have nothing to complain about. Holy Christ.
Seriously. This reminds me of just like walking around a neighborhood in Ithaca, New York recently. I found a book swap box, which is the first time I've ever seen one. And so and I took a look inside and nothing was like, you know.
There wasn't anything of interest.
Certainly nothing erotic in there. I'm wondering, are we feeling comedy with this idea? Does this scream drama? Do we want to basically like make a cartoon version of this or make a serious version of this or bring it to a sort of dystopic, futuristic equivalent?
I don't know.
With erotic books in a dystopic future?
Something that the dystopia has outlawed, right?
That's fair.
Censorship and yeah.
Yeah. And the idea of like something that is like public and communal.
Yeah.
Bringing out sort of a schism in the population, you know.
Sure.
Just
sure.
Policed by more extreme individuals.
Right.
Yeah. My first instinct is comedy, but not quite a cartoon comedy. Okay. And the first viable plot that like comes to my mind is, you know, somebody sets up this, what is it called? A book swap?
Yeah. It's just a little lending library. I think this is a quirk of UK US language that they call it a book swap box.
Right.
We call them little free libraries here.
Yeah.
Free
libraries. You could imagine anything from what I saw in Ithaca was more of like a mailbox shape, but all the way up to like a legit phone box. Like one of those. Like,
I just got the visual. Yeah. Yep. Okay.
And I'm just here filled now. With books. Yeah.
Yep. Great. Somebody sets one of these up for 3 months. Nobody touches it. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, beyond just, like, this is what I don't know yet. Why they're invested in making this book box a success.
Small town counselor. It's like their initiative.
Yeah. Sure. Or it's like their success. Daughter wants it.
That's always a good reason.
That's problematic before I'm about to go. Because then the way to get attention to it is she types up this, like, very, you know, angry letter. And all of a sudden, boom, everyone in town they're lining up to look through the book swap box.
Wow.
Like, you know, like it's kind of this publicity stunt, but then it gets like way bigger than they could have ever imagined it.
Out of control. Nice.
Because now all of a sudden the BBC is coming into town and they're like, we want to go door to door and find the angry person that left this. And they're like, oh, frick.
So here's the setup. Because of horribleness, the local library gets defunded. And the librarian forced into retirement takes it upon themselves to create the, you know, the free community version.
Yeah.
Right. And has to prove that there's demand to get the library back open again.
Yes. Ooh, and then maybe like slips one of the, their own books that they wrote in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. Oh my God. Yeah.
They like get it special printed. It was like never published actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You've seen Kinky Boots, everybody?
Yeah.
Yes.
So a Kinky Boots is a very charming British movie, if I'm getting that right, where a local town's shoe factory is like basically screwed. And in order to get back onto the, like, keep the town alive, basically they have to make very kinky boots, and it's a very like vanilla town, so it gets saucy and charming in a way that only a British comedy can.
It's fairly delightful. Yes,
there's a musical too,
and I feel like that's comedy without cartoon.
Yes, like I feel that is kind of a good wavelength for the sort of thing that comes to mind with something like this. Who is this librarian? Like, are they like a young person? Are they an old person?
Old was what jumped into my head, but I think it's incredibly fungible.
I think they could be any age. And the question is what motivates them that they've worked at the library for 30 years and it's their home and they need to sort of prove that it's a vital part of the town, or it's like they're out of library school and have come turned down a important archival job to like come be the librarian in their hometown. They're here, they're back here for 6 months, and then like the proposal comes up on the council to close the library, and they're like, no, I've built my whole life to like this moment. I have to stop this. So I think it could be either one.
I just got an email from Maggie Smith's agent. She's interested in the part.
She needs to do something. She hasn't been around since Downton.
Love it. Perfect.
The woman can do whatever or as little as she wants.
This is also true.
She is perfect. But she should be in this movie. She would be great. Cool.
If she's not the librarian, then Maggie Smith gives the librarian the advice to put erotic books in the swap box.
Sure.
Like 1,000%.
Actually, here's a good question. Do they actually put erotic books in the lock, in the swap box? Or do they just put up the note, the like letter complaining about the books?
Oh, and then the book becomes this thing of legend. It's like, did it even exist? And like, what was it? And
no, and you know what's the key to that? People like, someone gets interested and someone like goes there and they're like, you know, looking for a book title that is obviously erotic. None of them are. And so they're like, fuck. Well, I guess I'm going to just have to like pick one of these at random and read it and hope that it's the erotic one.
Right.
And all of a sudden people are actually reading the books to find out like where they got to get through them to find what the erotic one is. And all of a sudden people are like getting together to discuss the books and to just kind of like, you know, they kind of are forming book clubs.
Yeah.
Was it the Cornhole? What was the name of this town?
Cornholm
Book Club.
Oh my God. Jesus.
Oh, I love it. Well, you have about 2 minutes left. How does this resolve in the end, besides a love of reading?
Does the library get refunded again? Like, and the library is able to open up, and then like the little free library just becomes where they put all the erotica?
That would be perfect.
And I 100%, but I will add that I don't know how the plot would need to like twist on itself to make this necessary, but she ends up having to write an erotica book. Like, she ends up having to now feed the town's clearly insatiable hunger for erotic literature.
I think
she finds that she's really good at it too. Like, she's always struggled as an author of like, she's always kind of wanted to write the next great American novel and like really struggled through an MFA program, nothing doing. But
after she does the article to get the attention and people go in droves to go find it and there's nothing there, you get like, it was bullshit. So she has to get some, but for whatever reason, can't find, like, Amazon's not delivering, can't get it, has to write her own. It gets snapped up and disappears, has to keep replacing it. And then people want more. So she starts doing it. And rather than the old library getting refunded, there's a box on every block by the end of the movie.
Nice.
Oh, I like that.
That's
I
love great. It. Oh my God.
Oh, you don't need a library. You just need a community that reads. That's nice. Although libraries are also nice.
Yes.
I have a vision of the movie poster, which is basically a rip of Fight Club, but with a book instead of a bar of soap, like a and book club just.
And like the book has kind of something like vaguely erotic poking in the frame.
It's their self-published, self-bound first edition of whatever they had to write that brings everybody to the box.
Well, that's time.
I love it.
Oh, man. Beautiful.
Incredible.
I may need this movie now. This sounds so... Like, this is like that rare point where the Venn diagram of wholesome and erotic literature actually manages to like overlap and touch.
Yeah, I'm impressed.
Thank you so much for this charming idea.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Thank you guys for this charming soon to be HBO limited series.
Now I am very invested in finding out what actually did happen in the real God-fearing town, though, and who left that note.
We may never know.
Alas. Mm. Well, let's see if we can't dig up a little bit more about that story. Let's take a quick break while we do that, but then we're going to be back to talk a little bit more with our guest, Sarah Werner, right after these quick messages.
Hello, dear listeners. It is I, Zach Valenti, jumping into this episode with this brief announcement. Do you love No Bad Ideas? Do you support the work that Gabrielle, Sarah, and myself put out week after week, whether it is this show or any of our fiction programs, like our recent Unseen audio drama at unseen.show? If so, please head on over to nobadideaspodcast.com/support and sign up to give a monthly contribution to help us keep our lights on over here at Long Story Short HQ. Once more, that's nobadideaspodcast.com/support. And if you're not in a position to give or want to go the extra mile, please do share this program and any of our other work that you like. All right, that's it. Let's get back to more No Bad Ideas.
All right, everybody, welcome back to No Bad Ideas. We are once again here with special guest star Sarah Rhea Werner, who has many, many projects that she is constantly working on, a lot of plates to keep spinning. But before we talk about the spinning of those plates, Sarah, perhaps a good place to begin this conversation is just how did your journey towards podcasting begin? How did you find yourself drawn towards this medium? How did that fateful idea first pop into your head? Ooh, maybe I should make a podcast.
Well, that's very easy because it was given to me by someone else. So I can claim no credit for getting into podcasting. I never even thought about podcasting because I was always a writer. And I was the kind of writer who wanted to see their words on paper. And I had grown up reading books and I had grown
up. We were all so young once.
I know. The before times. I wasn't allowed to watch TV growing up. And so it didn't even like strike my mind that like that was a place where you could have writing. And so I didn't even think like, oh, I want to write movies. I want to write for TV. It was for me, it was only I want to write books because that's what I knew. That's what kept me sane. And that was my life, was reading books. And so I was like, well, of course I'm going to write books. And I started many novels. They're all still here in a drawer.
Nice.
Unpublished. But what I did start publishing was a blog. And so I was blogging for years and years. And, you know, it was a blog and everybody has one. Well, and it's interesting because we're getting to that place with podcasts now, but this was before everyone had a podcast. This is when everyone had a blog.
When it was like and peak blog saturation.
It was very, very, it was like 500 million blogs. And I think at the time there were only 200,000 podcasts, whereas now there's 2 million podcasts. Mm-hmm. So that's just like the growth trajectory that we've seen in 6 years. But at the time in 2014, when I was blogging, I was just voicing to a friend trend, like, oh, this isn't really having the impact that I want. I don't even know why I'm bothering doing this. Nobody's reading it. And he's like, well, hey, I just got back from New Media Expo 2014 or 2013.
Wow.
Remember that? And he was like, you know what you should do is start a podcast. And I was like, is that like a ham radio thing? And I didn't even know what it was. And so like he got me started listening to, I think Limetown had just come out maybe. And
nice.
Welcome awesome. To Night Vale was available. And I started listening to a lot of nonfiction podcasts. And I saw that there was like, you know, my blog before had been about creativity and about writing and about all sorts of things like that. You know, eventually it became the Right Now podcast. So yeah, so I launched the Right Now podcast. I want to say I launched it right away, but I didn't. I waited 2 years wow. because I was terrified.
Sure.
Because going from one medium to another, especially when you have all of these expectations of what it means to publish in one medium, which was like, oh, books are the only thing that matters. And it's like, I had to grow a little bit as a person and realize that, oh, I can tell stories and I can help people in all sorts of mediums. So, okay, I'm going to experiment with podcasting. So yeah, so 2015, I launched the Right Now podcast and it's still going. And I realized that I really loved podcasting. I loved, it was a shortcut between my brain to the microphone. I didn't have to write anything first because I don't script anything. I just talk. And it also like opened up this door of public speaking, which I realized I really love doing. And I was like, oh, okay. So this is all like together. This is
it's all there.
It's, yeah. it's all there in the voice. And so then in 2017, I was like, you know what? I've been having so much fun recording the Right Now podcast that, hey, I'm just going to start reading fictional stories into the microphone. And mm-hmm. so I just like recorded the first episode of Girl in Space on a whim and just recorded it. And then just was like, oh, I should probably put some like sound effects in here and stuff. And yeah. And so I released the first episode and it went really well. I think a lot of my audience came over from Right Now. And there was sure. just also a really beautiful burgeoning indie community with shows like Wolf 359 and Tin Can and just a lot of other great sci-fi shows that were taking off at the time. So yeah, the first episode of Girl in Space came out and people liked it. And I was like, well, okay, I guess now I should write some more episodes. And so I did. And that was really when I realized how fun it was to write for audio.
So that you actually put out the first episode of Girl in Space and only upon hearing from people turned to make more of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Wow. I did not actually know that.
Yeah, no, it was an experiment. And I was just like, let's just see. I like to treat everything I do as an experiment. Uh-huh. So that way, like if it fails, I'm like, well, it was just an experiment. I'm not disappointed, really.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I was just going to see like what it felt like to tell a fictional story in a podcast format. And yeah, and then, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I did not plan for more than one episode of Girl in Space. And I was like, well, now I have to tell a whole story. Actually, I didn't know what was going to happen. Like when that first episode ended and then I released it, I didn't know there were going to be more characters.
Now, in past interviews, kind of pinging off of that.
Yeah.
And this will perhaps clue our listeners into how closely I have followed your career that I know so much of your past interview catalog. In a past interview, you described yourself as a pantser rather mm-hmm. than a plotter.
Oh, mm-hmm. man, I was about to ask that question.
In a subsequent interview, when our good friend David Reinstrom asked you about this and asked you if you were still that way, you said that you described it as, unfortunately, yes, you are still a pantser. Do you think that you are still a pantser? And if so, why is that really unfortunate? Is that really a problematic thing?
Oh, this is such a good question. I love talking about this. So for those of you not versed in these very weird terminologies, you know, if you're a writer, you're said to be either a plotter or a pantser. Mm-hmm. And so either you plot your novel or your podcast or whatever it is, you know how it's going to end. You know how what happens in the middle, you know, act three, there's going to be an explosion. Whereas if you're a pantser, you just sit down and you just start like hitting keys until a story comes out and you don't have an outline.
Famously, like the pant stealing, was it gnomes?
The underpants gnomes.
Yes, that yes, is named yes. after.
Because you're writing by the seat of your pants. Like you're just, and I like that thing with the underpants gnomes as well. I had not heard that connection before, but.
Oh, I thought that that's where it was, where it's kind of like, you know, like
step one, slap the keys.
Step two, question mark. Right. Writing, question mark, story.
Right.
Step three, profit.
Yeah.
I had a brief time in my creative life when I felt like I should be outlining. Mm-hmm. And I read all of these books about writing practices. I read K.M. Wayland's Structuring Your Novel, not to be confused with K.C. Wayland, who does We're Alive. These are different people.
And writes phenomenal books.
Exactly.
On yeah, Bombs Always Beat. Highly recommend.
Yes. Yes. Which I also love.
But structuring your novel.
Exactly. And I was like, well, I should structure it. And it's so interesting to read how other people work and to think that you are doing it wrong. And it's a very interesting realization when you start using someone else's proven method and you realize that you suddenly hate everything you create. I figured, okay, so season one was very stressful. Season one of Girl in Space was very stressful for me because I was writing it by the seat of my pants and I was trying to keep up with a bi-weekly release of, you know, each episode, you know, takes a long time. So you have to coordinate with actors. You have to like write 900 drafts of it before you're satisfied. You know, you have to edit it. You have to do dialogue. Like I was doing everything myself and I still am.
You have to go back and you know what, let's do a couple more tweaks of the script. Uh-huh. Like that, like really things like the 901st draft that's going to really make it shine.
You know. And so I was trying to do that every 2 weeks on the fly. And it just got to a point where, and if you scroll through like old reviews of Girl in Space, they're like, is this show over? Is it done? It's been like, you know, 6 months since the last episode. And like, so that's what happened. And so for season two, I was like, okay, I'm going to be organized this time. I'm going to take the advice. I'm going to do an outline. I'm going to write the whole thing first. And then I'm going to coordinate with my actors. And it's going to be so impressive. And everybody's going to be like, wow, Sarah's finally doing it right. And I wrote an outline and all of a sudden I lost interest in the project altogether. And some other stuff was happening. You know, we have like this whole pandemic. I was also working on. This is big news. Big news.
And what?
We've all been living through a pandemic for the last year and a half. But I was working on a TV show for Netflix at the time and doing writing there. And it was just everything got pulled apart in my brain. And like, so anyway, I had to realize, and this realization just came to me seriously within the last few weeks, that if I'm going to do this, I'm going to have to do it my way. And, you know, for someone who's like, I'm almost 40 and to like have this realization that like, oh, as a creator, I'm allowed to do things the way that I want to do them. It feels so, it's embarrassing. You know, it's like, oh gosh, I should have like realized this in my early 20s. Like, instead of now when I'm a million years old. But yeah,
I mean, so I take hope from that, like that, both because I was incredibly dumb in my 20s. Yeah. And also just like that there's more things out there to internalize by living through it. Like,
yes.
That seems good.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I've learned, and that's, you know what, this is really, I think, the important thing that I've had to learn even just these past few weeks is that I'd been searching for a process. I'd been searching for a linear practice, right? Mm-hmm. To get from point A to point B. But when you're creating, there is no point A and point B because the process isn't linear. Mm-hmm. The process is iterative. The process is circular. The process is—it's not what it looks like in hindsight, right?
Like, it's like the Wonkavator; it moves sideways and diagonal and schnoz ways and all these different ways.
And it goes out the roof sometimes, and you're like, "Well, here I am, you know, flying around in a glass elevator, and I can't see the—you know—I can't see the ground, but that's okay because that's creativity." So I had that realization, and It was really liberating. It was really liberating. That's awesome. Because I'd been fighting so hard to like, okay. And it was like map. Everybody has this like mapped out. And this is just all so foreign to me. This is not how I'm used to working. But like, okay, when you start act three, you should be 57% of the way through. Now, this is where your hook comes back. And you need to have this. This is where you are in the redemption. And it's, I can't make a story like that because it's not genuine and it's not, you know, coming from the heart and it's not pantsed. I don't know. It's anyway. So I've realized that there is an element of spontaneity and unplannedness that I have to have if I'm going to stay interested in my work, which sounds really,
I'm very judgmental about myself, but it's like, oh, well, you're bored with your work that you get paid to do. That must be a real trial for you. But like, I can't create if I'm not interested in what I'm creating. I can't create if what I'm doing is not becoming, if what I'm doing is not searching and finding during the process. And so I've started to look at the creative process, not as a creation of a project, but as a way to live more deeply into your creative life. Because if you look back at season one of Girl in Space, and I've talked about this in other interviews, it's autobiographical. Like everything, every episode, whatever X is going through is some interpretation of what I am going through. And, you know, her rejection of Caldwell Enterprises taking over her life was, I wrote that as I was leaving my day job and preparing to write full time and to consult full time.
That's awesome.
Well, thank you. And so I learned that by like outlining things ahead of time, I wasn't giving myself space to explore what I was going through as I was going through it. Right.
Yeah.
And so I just actually yesterday I sat down to write and there was a thing that was going to happen in my outline. And I just was like, you know what, I'm done with the outline. And I just pantsed it. And I wrote about something that I was going through, you know, in a very sci-fi way. And it just felt so good. It was such a breakthrough. And now the story is completely off the rails again. And that's exactly where I want it to be.
That's awesome.
That's awesome.
So thank you for asking that question. It's something that I've been thinking a lot about lately.
Just because I'm always fascinated, a corollary to that question is, do you find that creativity is chaos, but do you find a different flavor of chaos when you move mediums? Like, I'm curious how it was for you to go from prose writing to audio storytelling. And then it sounds like TV writing was its own adventure. And just like, have you found preferences or lessons that you've been able to take from one to the other?
Yes. And I want to be like, so nobody's actually ever asked me this question before. So like the answer that you're getting is just like what comes off the top of my head.
That's exactly what the point of No Bad Ideas is. Just that,
excellent.
That pure undiluted reaction.
Yeah. This is going to sound just like so incredibly narcissistic, but like I really changed as a writer when I moved from writing novels to writing audio drama. And I think part of that was just because I was growing as a writer and just, you know, you start, you're terrible. You get a little bit more experience, you get a little bit better. But I really loved the freedom of constraint in writing for audio. So with a novel, it's just an open page and it's like ready, set, go. And it can be from any point of view. It can have as many characters as you need it to. It can be like whatever. It can be nonlinear. I feel like with audio drama, there were enough constraints there that I was actually more free to tell a story because I had less, if you're familiar with decision fatigue. Yeah. So having some constraints in place, like, okay, the story can be told through three things. The story can be told through dialogue, sound effects, and music. And that's literally it. Cause I decided I wasn't going to have like narrators or different points of view. Like it was just going to be like one microphone centered on one person's experience. And like having that constraint was extremely freeing because not in the sense of like where the story could go, but how I could tell the story. And it just made it so much easier and faster to tell the story that way. And I was like, oh, I love this. I don't have to worry about like polishing descriptions. I don't have to worry about all of the other things that I was worried about with a novel, because this was just dialogue, sound effects, and music. And it was just so beautifully like clarified for me in that way. And then it's interesting too, writing for TV, because what I was doing for TV was I was adapting this audio drama that I had written into TV, and it just got rid of all those constraints. And so all of a sudden I was like out of my element again. And I was like, oh, we have to write like visual stuff. And we lose the constraint of audio only. So now it's audio, but we're also balancing that against what's possible visually.
Yeah.
And that was such a hard leap for me to make because I was used to having everything come out in audio.
And now to say like, oh, we can have a scene of complete silence. There's no dialogue. There's just this character looking around and like, how do we orchestrate that through the words and the script? And it was just a completely new experience for me. So I think what I'm saying is I really, really love the constraints of writing for audio. It's just a little bit easier on my brain to have like limits. Did that answer your question?
No, that may, it did, and it makes total sense.
Okay, good.
Yeah, no, I think we have talked about, all three of us, singly and together, how constraints are your friend.
Yeah.
And they actually make, they simplify things down so that you can sort of hone in on the character work in a really cool, freeing way.
Yeah, and the characters are what I care about, and like the dialogue is my favorite thing to write, and so it's like, oh, I can get rid of all that other stuff I wasn't very good at and just like write the dialogue. Like, this is great.
That's awesome.
I'm curious, as you were approaching the audio fiction medium, you mentioned maybe Limetown, Welcome to Night Vale. Were there any other sort of touchstones that you look back on being like, wow, that really helped me sort of grok what I was about to go do?
Yeah. Tin Can by David Devereaux. And they've since come out with a lot more shows, but I think, I don't know if that was the only one they had at the time, but I was really interested in solo voice shows because, again, at the time I was not planning to have a cast or anything. Right. So I was listening to Spines by Jamie Killen. I was listening to Tin Can. I was listening to, well, I was listening to Wolf 359, which existed. Not at the time, I think. Well, no, because you started in 2014. Yeah. No. Yes. Yep. Okay. I didn't discover you yet. I didn't discover Wolf 359 until I was looking into the sci-fi stuff and looking to create Girl in Space. And I was like, oh my gosh.
Nobody discovered us in 2014.
Okay. Like, that makes me feel a little better.
Nobody discovered us that early. Yeah.
Definitely not. I don't think even my parents had.
And it's interesting too. And like doing research for this show, I don't know if this happens to you as well, but like you're looking around for other stuff and you're like, oh, well, there's already this like really cleverly written, like sci-fi comedy that's like very dry and kind of fun and observant. And I was like, oh, why so bother?
Why should I even do my thing? All right. Never mind.
Right. Right. And like, so that was a freedom that I had with the Right Now podcast, was like, there weren't a lot of writing shows when I started Right Now. And like that could be my own thing. And I was like enjoying it. If I was going to start the Right Now podcast today, I would be so terrified because there's so many people with really good shows about creativity. And so with Girl in Space, what I became fixated on was like, how can I make this different? Right. Yeah. Like, because there's shows like Tin Can, and then Mars Fall, I think, came out like right at the same time Girl in Space did. And I was like, oh, no, I hope my show is different enough from theirs. Mm-hmm. But really, I think what I learned through that was, if you create something, and again, like Girl in Space was autobiographical, if you put yourself into it, it will be a different story. Like, there's so many sci-fi shows now, like, and I'm not even worried with season two of Girl in Space that it's similar to anything. Like, I'm just telling the story that's like true to me and to my experience. And yeah, but that was definitely something I had to get over at the time, was like, oh, everybody's going to think I'm copying Wolf 359 or The Bright Sessions or, you know, whatever, Mars Fall. Yeah.
Now, Sarah, aside from Right Now, you also spend a lot of time doing online learning and online education.
I do.
I was curious about something that you were actually talking about in the last Right Now episode, where you were talking about how sometimes the people that are best at a thing are not always the best ones to explain the thing, which makes complete sense, because sometimes it's like, you know, you take someone like, say, like Ernest Hemingway or something, and it's like, well, if being a great writer is a place on First Street, well, maybe he happened to be born on Third Street. And for him, it's like, how do you get to be a great writer? Well, you go out of your house, you make like two turns, and boom, you're there. But that's not really helpful if you're someone that was born on 159th Street, or if you're someone that was born two towns over, if you're someone that was born in Australia. It can actually be helpful to kind of have someone that is like, okay, maybe I haven't risen as high, but I've done more of the journey, and I kind of have that map, and I can share it with you. I guess my question is, like, what do you think is sort of the value and the importance of, you know, kind of having people that not only create art, but talk about their processes and their struggles in a helpful, teachable way. Mm.
So this is so near and dear to my heart. And like you said, it's something that even today I'm still thinking about and wondering about the value of. So like full disclosure, like I have a podcasting course and I know you guys have a very excellent show about creating an audio drama. Sorry, I said show. I meant course.
It's a little bit of a show. It's okay.
Okay.
There's animations.
Oh, see, that's even better. And I think that, well, like I said earlier, in response to another question, like, you know, I was approaching a lot of these educational opportunities and I was coming to it with this idea that I didn't know anything or that my ideas were like less than the teacher. So again, this might be unique to my background, but like, you know, not watching TV growing up, just like being completely in awe of people who wrote books and who taught. I was very like hungry for knowledge. And I just like venerated writers and authors and teachers in a way that was probably not super healthy, but like, and I'm still like that today. I see somebody who is doing a great job and I'm like, I need to learn from you because I am obviously doing everything wrong and you're obviously doing everything right. So I think there's like a little bit of tempering and a need to like honor your own experience and the lessons that you've learned. I've also learned that there's, you know, while there's really no wrong way to do something creatively, there's really no right way to do it either. And I know that can be frustrating if you're looking for answers. There's only what works for you.
Right.
And I know that like relativism is a really frustrating place to land if you're looking for instruction, right? You're looking for the right and the wrong way to do things. But really, the right and the wrong way to do things come from not a place of creativity and creative growth, but this idea of right and wrong come from a fear of being ridiculed or a fear of being different or a fear of being rejected, right?
Yeah. So
if we're going to be like fully creative, we really have to embrace the fact that there's really no right or wrong way to do it. And so keeping that in mind, you know, I do love to learn from other people. And so reading books like Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott, taking courses like yours and like mine about podcasting, I think that those are really good because you need to have seed ideas, right? You need to like start the engine with something. That's a terrible analogy. Just pretend it was a really good analogy.
Right.
You need to have, because the way that we form ideas, or at least the way I form ideas, is by like curating things from different sources. Like my brain and maybe your brain too is like a mashup machine. So like I'll take one thought from one course that I take and one thought from a book that I read about writing, and my brain will mash those up into a little sandwich that works for me.
Yeah.
These analogies are terrible.
No, I think they're great.
Okay.
And just because you told me to pretend they are. Genuinely like them.
Okay. So you end up with like these mashups, right? Of things that work for you and things that don't work for you. And I think that that's where I am right now is like, right now I'm reading Start Ugly by David Duchemin. I'm reading Dusk, Night, Dawn by Anne Lamott. I'm constantly reading. I'm reading fiction. I'm reading nonfiction. I'm constantly listening to podcasts just because our ideas come from other people's ideas. Like it's just right. So it's like, we're always going to a museum and seeing new exhibits and then like taking away things that spark our interest. And then that's where our own ideas and our own creativity come from. Because I don't know, I believe that creativity is organic and iterative. I used to work in website and marketing development, and we would have a saying, and that was garbage in, garbage out. Yeah. And so you need to continue feeding good ideas into your brain so that you can continue generating good ideas. You need to be very careful with what you take in as truth. You need to be a little bit discerning about, you know, do I love this idea because I admire the person it came from? Or, you know, like I talk about in my podcast episode, I really admire the person this idea came from, but that idea does not work for me. And, you know, I'm going to get just gently honor and respect that and then get rid of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that we constantly need to be taking in good, smart content if we're going to be creative, if we're going to keep understanding how we work as individuals and if we're going to become artists.
I love that. I think that's great.
Thank you. I think you're great.
Sarah, we could talk to you all day about this. Seriously, if we did not have to run to attend to our various other jobs, we really could just stay here and do this for another 2 hours. But in case people want to pick up their conversation with you and your amazing content, what's the best place to do that? Where should they go to find more of your creations and more of your thoughts?
Come on over to my website. I just sort of, you know, I could say like, oh, I'm on all these social medias and I'm out here and here. But really my website, sarahwerner.com, that's S-A-R-A-H-W-E-R-N-E-R.com, is sort of the hub for everything. You can find links to the Right Now podcast. Well, no, I wouldn't go that far. it's like a slow dribble maybe, which is a really terrible way to describe your own website. Just ignore all that. Go to sarahwerner.com.
It's like a spring and tuck everlasting. It's
there
like
you go.
But it's
I love that. But rewarding. Thank you. Yes. Thank you. That's the most beautiful thing I've ever heard. So yes, go to the spring that is sarahwerner.com. There's links to Girl in Space, Right Now podcast. I have a newsletter that I send out every Monday called Dear Creators. I have create-alongs every Wednesday and Friday over on Twitch. It's all free. It's all there for you to have for free.
Highly recommended that you do it, dear listeners. I think you're going to find it very, very rewarding.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you again so much for being on the show. It's been really, really awesome.
Thank you. It's been just such a delight to like see your process and to see your faces throughout this. You're doing some really, really great work here. So thank you.
This has been No Bad Ideas, produced by Gabrielle Urbina, Sarah Shackett, and Zach Valenti. Many thanks to our patrons for their partnership in making this show happen. And a special shout out to our Idealist members, Jennifer Schneider, Rena Sarame, and Rebecca Allen. Today's episode features music by State Shirt and Jazar from freemusicarchive.org. You can support the show at nobadideaspodcast.com/support. And if you love this show, please leave a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Thanks.